Open the pod shop door, please, Hal. Hello again, fellow sufferers, and welcome to the second installment of the Vancouver Public Library's first ever Writer's Pod Shop, the workshop that comes in the form of a podcast. I am Spider Robinson, the VPL's sixth writer in residence and your pod shop steward for the duration. Let the magic start without delay this time. I apologize in advance for any mispronunciations I may perpetrate of the names of your story, your characters, your setting, or yourself. And so, at elapsed time, 48 seconds in, we begin VPL Pod Shop number 2 with manuscript number 1, Domestic Disturbance by Tracy Ekdahl, writing as Trace Kyler. This was the day she was going to poison him. A little rat killer in his coffee would do the trick. She'd never do it, of course, just a little fantasy on mornings like this. The crunching of toast was like nails on a chalkboard to Helen. Why couldn't he chew with his damn mouth closed? He had the table manners of a 2-year-old. And he was doing it again, licking his finger before turning the page of the newspaper. Oh, how that got under her skin. Tully, are you listening? There's something wrong with the phone. No matter who I call, they can't hear me on their end. Several ticks of the clock echoed through the room. Tully! Was all he said. For all she knew, he was saying it to the newspaper. His eyes never stopped scanning the print. Breakfast had been playing out like this for the past few days. Instead of asking for eggs and bacon or waffles, he made himself a bowl of cereal. He even made his own toast. "How long has this coffee been on?" she asked. It smelled stale, like it was made the night before. Forget it, she'd make a new pot after he left for work. If he was willing to drink the stale stuff, there was no use throwing it out. She sat at the table and stared at the top of his receding hairline. He used to have a gorgeous head of hair. Now it was sitting on top, and his forehead was expanding.
"I asked you a question."
No response.
"If you're going to continue to ignore me, you can do the cleaning up yourself. It'll give you an idea what I do around here all day. Cleaning up after you is what I do. You'd think it was the sole purpose of my existence."
She sighed and stared at her wedding ring, spinning it repeatedly around her finger. "Remember when we used to go dancing?" He snorted out a laugh, licked his finger, and turned the page. "We used to get dressed up. You had that sharkskin suit, and I wore fishnets. You always tore through them when we got home." She laughed. The memory could still bring a flush to her cheek. "You were so light on your feet." Now look at him, pot-bellied and soft. She knew these days she was less domestic goddess and more domesticated frump. Still, if they just put in the effort. He carefully folded the newspaper and finished off the dregs of his coffee, which she thought must have been cold by now. Picking up his jacket and briefcase, he left without saying a word. She sat back, deflated. So this is how it was going to be. Well, to hell with him. She really wasn't going to clean up. Let him do it his damned self. She was not going to be treated this way. She just wasn't. When she looked at the clock, it said 6:45. Where had the day gone? The sound of a key in the lock told her Tully was home, back from a hard day at work. Yeah, right. He added and subtracted for a living. How hard could that be? The briefcase hit the floor by the door, same as it did every night. Tully walked into the living room and threw his suit jacket on the chair. He plopped down beside her on the well-worn couch.
"That does not go there," she said, pointing to the jacket.
He picked up the remote and turned the channel to sports news.
"How was your day?"
As if she really cared.
"Shit,"
he said. To her or the sports score, she couldn't really tell.
"Did you call about the phone?"
"Shoot."
"So does that mean you forgot? I'll bet it was for one of your friends you would have remembered."
She was in full sulk mode now.
"Just for that, make your own dinner. I'm on strike."
He ignored her and walked out of the room. She found him in the kitchen.
"You hear me? I'm not lifting a finger until I get some respect around here."
Tully took a frozen dinner from the freezer, removed it from the box, and threw it in the microwave. She opened her mouth to tell him about poking holes in the top, then thought otherwise. Let him figure it out for himself. Since when did they buy frozen dinners, anyway?
She pulled her attention from the microwave and centered it squarely on the beer in his hand. "Since when did you start drinking again? You know those extra carbs aren't good for you." His response was to take another pull from the bottle. He smiled a devilishly satisfied smile. "I was thinking," she said, as she leaned against the scarred Formica counter. "Our 10-year anniversary is coming up. I think we should do something special. Go on a vacation. Grace went on a cruise with her husband when they were, you know, having troubles. Work wonders for them." She bit her lip. "What do you say?" Tully lifted his beer in the air and said, "Here's to you, Helen." He put it to his lips and drank the contents in one long go. Like some frat kid, she thought. It didn't even matter that he never thought to make her any dinner. She wasn't hungry anyway. She was giddy with excitement. They were going on a cruise. Everything was going to work out. They were going to work out. After he ate, he cleaned off the table and did the dishes. She couldn't remember the last time he'd done that. Even when she was sick with the flu, he'd left the dishes for her. With the plates put away, he dried his hands and went to the front door, where he picked up a box. She followed him into the living room. "You bought me a present? You mean you didn't forget our anniversary?" She clapped her hands with joy. "I love you, Tully. You know, this is the first year you've remembered." Tully carefully opened the box and stared at the contents a moment. He went to the bookcase and took down the crystal glasses they'd used to make their wedding toast. "What are you doing with those?" Her mouth gaped. "You put those back." In their place, he put the ugliest vase she'd ever seen. He placed the glasses carefully in the vase box and left the room. "Where are you going with those?" she called after him. She eyed the vase suspiciously. It really was unattractive. It looked marble, but knowing him, it was probably fake. When she took a closer look, she saw a brass plate glued to the front. On it was her name and birth date. And another date. This year's date. How could this be? She found him upstairs putting the crystal glasses on the top shelf of the hall closet. "You think this is funny? This is some kind of joke? Answer me, damn you!" He ignored her. Rage bubbled inside her, and she slapped him in the face. Only her hand made no contact. Instead, it passed right through him. How was this possible? Could she really be dead? She didn't remember dying. It was something one would assume she would remember. "Tully!" He paused at the top of the stairs and turned. He'd heard her. She was sure of it. "Tully!" The scream echoed down the hall. "Helen?" His jaw went slack, and he took a step back. She could hear a sickening crunch as he tumbled down the stairs. After a moment, he stood up. Only the solid part of him didn't. He looked down to see his own neck craned far beyond its reach. "Now look what you've done!" He pointed down at his corpse as he glared up at her. She brought her shaking hand up to her mouth and whispered, "I'm sorry." "You're sorry. Helen is sorry. I guess that makes it all right, then. What the hell am I supposed to do now?" As she descended the stairs, she contemplated. "This doesn't have to be a bad thing. Now we can be together forever." She smiled warmly. "Why would I want to do that?" he said, flat and even. "Have you got a hole in your head?" "Oh, that's right, you do. Quite literally. I don't want that, you silly cow. I don't want you. That's why I killed you." The end. At elapsed time 8:52, VPL Podshop number 2 continues with manuscript number 2, The Raising, by Daniel Gore. Chapter 12. It's a shame about Keelum. Bren and Endera sat at the table nearest the fire, sipping their hot cider ale as they spoke. Every so often they fell silent as Adina entered the commons room of the inn to serve its patrons, taking orders and curtly answering questions. Aaron had insisted that she find work, and it appeared that her schooling did little more for her than leave her short-sighted, along with the rotund figure of an easy lifestyle. She left again, and Bren continued.
"You started off so well. Such an apt pupil. Frighteningly talented, in fact. But someone, Aaron, I imagine, planted a seed of poison in his mind."
"It isn't your fault he left," Andero responded distractedly. She kept glancing to her left at a man and woman seated against the far wall. The pair spoke only in whispers without looking at one another, instead opting to scan the room repeatedly. Both were dressed as travelers, although Andero caught a glimpse of a hardened leather cuirass under the woman's overcoat. Bren shook his head. "I know, I just wish I could have worked it out of him, those foolish notions of conciliation and unity. He's a warrior, even if he doesn't want to be. Every action belies it." Andera furrowed her brow. "Like how he told Aaron what we were teaching him just to get away from us?" Bren grimaced, then took a sip of his ale. "Hey, at least he took care of our keel infestation." As he put his mug down, the door opened, letting in a young man along with a gust of cold winter air. He looked around the tables until he saw the couple and made his way towards them. "I'm Jared," he announced. They glanced back and forth between him and each other, confused, until Bren's eyes widened in recognition. "Keelum's friend, right?"
"That's right. I came because he sent me."
"And why couldn't he come himself?" Andera demanded angrily. "Couldn't bear to face us?"
"He's tied up."
"Doing what? Lecturing the other slaves on obedience?"
"No, he's tied up in the shed."
The couple looked at him, once again confused. Jared frowned in frustration.
"It's where the mistress throws slaves to punish them."
"Well," Bren hummed, "maybe there's hope for him yet. What did he do?"
"Nothing. The mistress got a mysterious message, then decided to sell him. She's going to wait for the snow to let up, but I don't think he'll last that long in the cold. Please, you must do something."
Andera leaned back in her chair. "What do you propose that we do?" Jared lowered his head, staring at the table to avoid their eyes.
"You could offer to buy him."
"Excuse me."
They all turned to the speaker, who had approached from behind. It was the woman that Andera noticed earlier, and her companion stood to her side.
"We couldn't help but overhear your predicament, and I believe we have a solution. We are traders, and I need an aide. We could purchase your friend," she said, nodding to Jared, who had stepped to one side, "and take him far from here. It would keep him out of the quarries, and we would treat him well."
Andera frowned, but Bren spoke.
"We're listening."
"We must see him first. I do not wish to get anyone's hopes up, so this must be done in confidence. You must tell us where he is right now."
By now, the crowd that had formed around this small table had attracted the attention of other patrons, as well as Adina. She had been listening with keen interest for several minutes and took this moment to step in. "Bren," Andera said as she gave him a sidelong look, but Adina cut her off.
"I know where he is, locked up tight in the shed on my mother's estate. Ignore these fools. Mother wouldn't sell him to them, not after what they did to him. If you want to see him, you'll have to see her. You don't know what trouble you're getting yourself into, though."
"That's enough, girl," Andera exclaimed, coming to her feet. The rest of the room fell silent at her outburst, waiting to see what would happen next, but Andera simply crossed her arms and lowered her voice, a baleful smile on her face. "Don't you think you ought to market him a little better?" She looked down at her partner, where he sat sipping his ale and grinning, enjoying his woman in action.
"I think it's time we go."
He stood and followed her out the door. Jared watched as the door closed, stared at it for a moment longer, before following after them. The major turned back to the waitress, who watched as Jared left the inn.
"Where is the man kept?"
"On our estate, east 1 hour, then up the road at the signpost for the Drayden estate. I'm almost finished. I can take you there afterwards."
"That sounds good."
Adina smiled and turned, going back into the kitchen. Both the major and the messenger waited until she was out of sight before sitting back down.
"That couple are definitely going at it undrugged. It's all over his face. We should haul them in."
"That's not what we're here for," the messenger grumbled as four more similarly dressed women joined them. "We have come this far. We know where the man is. Let's get him."
"Not quite yet," Charon whispered, turning to one of the newcomers. "Rodan, follow those two."
"But I said—"
The major raised her hand and continued speaking over his objections. "Follow them and find out what they know and what they are planning. If they are a threat, kill them." The woman nodded, and putting a hand on the hilt of her concealed blade, stood and left the room. Bren and Andera trudged through the snow, following a path cut by dozens of feet.
"What was that about?" Bren queried, mildly annoyed that he didn't get to finish his drink.
Andera looked around to see if anyone was nearby.
"I know the woman. I couldn't place her at first, but now I remember. Charon. Last I heard, she joined the Secret Service."
And she didn't recognize you?
I don't think so, or she wouldn't have pretended to be someone she wasn't in front of me.
And her companion?
I don't know, but he wasn't the only one. I noticed at least two others in the inn that suddenly held a keen interest in our conversation the moment you mentioned Keelum. It would be odd for them to only travel as three, so there must be others. At least two, I imagine.
Brent shook his head in disbelief.
That would make a quarter lance. What would they want with Keelum?
I suspect they found him out, and maybe us. Either way, his life is in danger. We need to plan.
They both broke into a trot and did not exchange another word until they reached the house. They found Jared standing under the eave, hugging himself and shivering. His legs were wet from cutting across the fields to beat them to their house. Bren raised an eyebrow and the corner of his lip in a lopsided smile.
You have nimble feet for a gimp.
Jared glared back. I'm fast when I need to be. I'm not going to give up on my friend. He,
as you shouldn't, Brent cut him off,
patting his shoulder warmly. Come inside. We will talk.
Jared followed the two into the house silence, dumbfounded as to how he had convinced them so effortlessly.
Bren stoked the fire while Endera sat him down at the table.
There are five soldiers in town and two guards at the shed, Jared interjected. They are less of a concern. These women are trained fighters. We cannot hope to stand up to all of them.
Can't we get him out before they come? Jared asked.
We can't buy him. Even if Aaron would agree to sell him to us now, Charon would simply outbid us. Even if we did get him, they'd come find us. We'd still have to fight to protect him, giving these women free license to do whatever they want to us. Not that they need an excuse.
Both Endera and Jared looked at the ground, pursing their lips.
Bren joined them, brushing ash from his hands.
I have an idea.
His two accomplices both looked up expectantly, Endera without a hint of a hope in her eyes, but Jared brimming with it.
I can get help, but if I am successful, Keelum will need to escape. You two put supplies together while I am gone.
He turned to Endera.
Pack the kaneshki that we had made for him.
She nodded gravely.
Bren stood, disappeared into the bedroom for a moment, and returned with a sheathed blade in his hand.
Wait, Endera said, stood, reaching out to him.
Who are you getting exactly?
The husky man cocked another lopsided grin, but his eyes were sober.
I'm not sure, exactly, but I know where to find him.
Or her.
He looped the sheath's webbing over his shoulder, cinched it tight, and stepped through the back door and into the cold night.
Chapter 13.
The moment the door closed behind Bren, he broke into a sprint, stomping through the virgin snow as he made his way across the field. He stopped at the edge of the forest and searched along the tree line to make sure he had found the right place. As he looked, what sounded like a single foot crunching snow came from his left. He held his breath and listened, thinking for a moment that someone had followed him. Nothing more could be heard, and he dismissed it as snow falling from a branch. Bren took a deep breath and entered the woods, wading into the dark unknown. He stumbled near blind over the uneven terrain, reaching his hands out to grab tree trunks as he passed by them. He reached the edge of the clearing. Moonlight spilled through the hole in the foliage above, illuminating a giant meringue tree at one end. Broad, heavy leaves still covered its branches, defiant of the freezing winds and heavy snow. Bren remembered finding this place one summer several years ago while looking for Keelum. The young man did not notice him at first, fully absorbed by his task. He stepped and leaped in an incredibly fluid, precise dance. It was certainly nothing Bren or Endera had taught him. He shouted to Keelum, startling him. The youth immediately looked around, and only after seeing that they were alone did he greet Bren, relief evident in his voice. But now the clearing showed no sign of any human presence. Only numerous large and small animal tracks crisscrossed the snow. He stepped into the center of the clearing and shouted,
"Hello there! Come out!"
He paused and listened.
"In Keelum's name, show yourself!"
He held out his hands to show that they held no weapon, and slowly rotated as he spoke. Without warning, a dark object flew directly at him from beyond the edge of the clearing and hit him across the chest, knocking him to the ground. He gasped for air, grabbing the warm, soft projectile as he fumbled to separate himself from it. He rolled it over, and the face of one of the soldiers appeared from between the folds of cloth, cold, lifeless eyes staring into his, locked in horror.
He looked down the length of her limp body and found her hand clutching the hilt of a blade hidden beneath her overcoat, half drawn from its sheath. The soft crunch of snow drew Bren's attention from the body at his knees, and what he saw gripped him in terror. A massive Sorin trampled towards him on all fours, its teeth bared and with rage in its eyes. It stopped in front of him, spraying him in a cloud of powder. Bren's heart sank. He had failed in his mission to find Keelum's mentor, and instead would be torn to pieces by this enraged beast.
"Fool," it growled, "sending only one assassin for me while you lured me into the open."
Bren's first thought was that the Sorin was barely understandable, but then realized what he was thinking. It knew his language. The lilt on his tongue, the intonation, he had all heard before, so many times he almost didn't notice it. Every hint of it was in Keelum's words whenever he spoke. The Sorin reached forward with one arm and grabbed Bren under the shoulder, crushing his ribs as it lifted him into the air.
"Wait," he rasped painfully. "I'm Bren."
The beast lifted him so that his face was level with its eyes, so close that their noses nearly touched, and grunted.
"Keelum's human teacher. He mentions you from time to time. He has told me you think more highly of Sorin than others. For that, I will let you explain yourself."
The Sorin dropped him to the ground, letting him fall to his hands and knees. Bren breathed heavily, forcing the words through the pain in his chest.
"Keelum is in danger. I came for your help."
"And the assassin?"
"She must have followed me. I must thank you. If you had not caught her, she would probably have killed me."
"Don't be so grateful just yet."
Bren ignored the implicit threat and looked up. It all makes sense now, how Keelum became so strong and fast. He could dance around me like I was a cripple. The Sorin grunted again.
"You humans are slow."
Bren frowned, wondering if it was referring to more than just his physical aptitude. He rethought how well he understood Keelum.
"He is human, isn't he?"
This time the Sorin frowned.
"More or less."
It raised its voice in annoyance.
"What is this threat?"
"Aaron locked him in the shed and has him up for sale."
"Serves him right."
"True, but there is also a quarter lance of predators after him. Less one," he said, looking down at where the body lay.
"Then he is in mortal danger."
The beast turned and disappeared into the forest. Bren also turned and, clutching his chest, rushed back to the house. That was The Raising by Daniel Gore. At elapsed time, 22 minutes and 40 seconds, VPL Podshop number 2 continues with manuscript number 3, The Navigators by Nina Kessler. Chapter 1, Inoculations. Rannoch made his way to the medical clinic. It was a pleasant walk along the landscaped pathway from his quarter in the Adept's compound to the clinic. The hot season was ending, and the prickly ear plants were spouting red pods from their gray stalks, adding welcome color along the way. Rannoch knew that each pod would grow hairy seed tufts, and the cooler winds of winter would blow them to new areas. It reminded him of one of the popular tunes he played on his flute. "The wind whispers from the open lands, it promises a new start for those with open hands and those with open hearts." Rannoch hummed a tune he knew so well, but a transport ship momentarily drowned out the song as it flew overhead. He looked up as the ship shaded him, and the song was replaced by the code displayed on the oval ship's hull, 42G. It was the regular transport to Growth Colony 42 on the nearest planetoid to Cassia, a planetoid he had never been. The ship flew over the curved walls of the buildings, and he turned to watch it speed over the city and the Great Hall as it disappeared. The round shape of the oligosphone tower jutting up from the Great Hall reminded him that he had to hurry back. Master Rin was waiting for him so they could review some older texts before preparing the evening's meditations. Rannoch turned and hurried along. At the clinic, Rannoch sat down and looked at the image monitor while he waited. The IM flashed,
"New advancement in nutritional health. The Vita-1 health formula supports the immune system and replenishes depleted vitamins in the body."
Everyone knew about the Vita-1 formula, and the first inoculations of Diapelsi began a week ago.
The medical magistrates had been working on it for a couple of years, and they hailed it as the answer to the food shortage.
Rannick, they're waiting for you.
The Sirku woman's smile accentuated the roundness of her face. She kept smiling at him till he walked past her and down the smooth walled hallway. Like most Sirku smiles, it made Rannick feel disconcerted. It was a smile unlike Zansi's, whose smile was soft and flowing.
Hello, have a seat.
The nurse in the small room didn't even look up. She was picking out the syringe from the counter. Rannick sat down and put his arm on the rest of the simple chair. He pulled the sleeve up of his emblazoned tunic. The nurse turned round and noticed it.
Oh, the crest of Heros, you must be an adept at one of the great halls.
Rannick nodded. The nurse wiped an antiseptic on a small circle of his silver skin. She said,
I tried going to the great hall in my neighborhood for a while, but it just didn't seem to work for me. I could see the night aura and I chanted, but I didn't feel any different.
The nurse paused, then jammed the needle into Rannick's arm without warning. Rannick gritted his teeth as the Vita One was squeezed into his veins. He could feel a liquid bulge as his vein tried to take it all in. The nurse didn't notice his discomfort. Her attention was on the fluid in the syringe. When it was empty, she pulled the needle out and got rid of it in a jar on the counter next to her. Then she turned to Rannick and said,
You of Pelsey are so artistic. We have a night aura painting made by one of my father's servants before the equity rulings. It's beautiful. Do you paint?
No, I'm an oligosphone musician.
Well, that does take talent. When I was young, I was allowed to go into an oligosphone tower, and I was shown how light was controlled to cause vibrations in the crystal. It was too overwhelming for me. The crystal suspended over my head made me claustrophobic.
Rannick didn't know how to reply, so he just nodded.
Anyway, the shot will support your...
I know. The nurse smiled.
Okay, take care. We will contact you again later.
At least she knew what an oligosphone is, Rannick thought as he made his way back to the Great Hall. Most Sirku only attended the Great Hall when circumstance required it, such as a funeral or tying, and they rarely showed interest in the workings of the oligosphone. The conversation with the nurse had left his mind as surely as his feet left the road when he stepped into the entryway of the Great Hall. The green tapestries were tied back so he could look straight across the mezzanine to the study alcove, where Master Rin was standing with his back to Rannick. Rannick thought the master's hair seemed more gray today than he remembered it. His arm pulsed at the needle puncture, and he pulled up the loose sleeve of his shirt. A blue bruise was starting to show against his silver skin, and he lightly rubbed it to calm it.
You're back,
Master Rin called from the alcove.
Rannick looked up. Yes, but the nurse was awful. She hurt you?
Yes, but I'll be okay. What did you find?
Rannick made his way to Master Rin's side.
I have one of the old texts here. Well, it's a copy. The original is at the Heros Magistrate. It says the prophet had traveled beyond the edge and reached a golden land.
Yes, the Crystalline Valley, according to our teachings.
But there are no other references to a visit there in this text, and she spent most of her time in space by the Great Barrier. I wonder if that is the edge referred to.
You think that this belongs to the Great Discovery period rather than a fragment of her early travels?
I do, and I would like us to explore the idea together.
But we can't get past the Great Barrier now with our superior ships. How could she have done it? Well, unless the barrier was thinner then.
Actually, the barrier was thicker.
Master Rin paused.
The script mentions a key.
Well, we have the key crystal, but the oligosphone wasn't created then.
And she couldn't carry the whole instrument with her. It needs the focusing of the other crystals around it.
Master Rin motioned his hand above his head, as if he were pointing to the crystals.
I haven't seen the key crystal in such a long time. It is so magnificent.
It is still in the tower.
Master Rin grunted his acknowledgement, then said,
I think we need some tea. I'll be back.
Rannick watched Master Rin as he left the alcove to enter the door leading to his adjoining chambers. Then Rannick looked to the front of the hall to the oligosphone tower and the window that allowed the light to reach the mezzanine, and he realized Master Rin could see the crystal again, even though it was difficult for him to mount the stairs of the tower. The sacred atom keeps us whole. Rannick said the words without thinking as he put on the gloves. Any scratch, no matter how small, would ruin the delicate balance of the oligosphone's crystal matrix. In the low light, his eye membranes had retracted, making his eyes dry. Squinting, he set his sight on the key crystal. Firmly fitting his fingers around it, he felt the gloves grip its smooth surface. Rennick cautiously tugged. The crystal remained unscathed. The shiny metal brace didn't let it go. He held his breath and tugged again. The crystal slipped away too smoothly this time. His fingers wobbled under the weight of the precious stone. Is it okay? The question shot through his mind. Rennick quickly brought the key crystal over to the globe light in the tiny room of the tower. The crystal was as long as his hand, slim and deceptively dull out of its holder. As he twirled it in the light, he could see its surface was unscratched. Satisfied, he was about to drop it into the pocket of his long vest. Oh! He startled himself as he lifted his hand away from his pocket. His unconscious had saved him. Cradling it, he easily walked the tight passage to the exit with the wall one side and the oligosphone on the other. He used his shoulders to open the tower door and then carefully stepped down the stairs into the great hall. Master Rin was not at the study alcove when Rennick arrived with the key crystal, so he stood with his hands out, waiting to offer the crystal to one who wasn't there. Rennick didn't need to wait long. Master Rin stepped into the great hall from his adjoined rooms, his slippers scuffling against the floor. Rennick sighed. Old age was catching up to the master. The slippers were inappropriate for his position, and he wasn't bringing tea. Instead, he carried a book, his finger carefully sandwiched between its covers, marking a spot. He placed the book on the table in front of Rennick.
"What do you have there?" Master Rin asked.
"I brought you the key crystal."
"You did?"
"You said you wanted to see it, and you have a hard time with the stairs, so I decided to bring it to you." Master Rin's eyes closed a moment, and Rennick knew he was weighing the circumstance. Rennick wondered if it had been a mistake to take the crystal out of the tower. The verdict was out. Master Rin opened his eyes and stepped forward.
"Well, let's take a look at it."
Rennick smiled. After his parents died as a child, Rennick had tried to live up to the master's standards. After all, it was the master that raised him and taught him the mysteries of the oligosphone. Master Rin bent down a bit and looked at the crystal closely.
"It's still in good shape. As fine as the day I first saw it. Can you hold it a bit longer? I want to read something to you."
Rennick nodded. Master Rin turned to the book and read a passage out loud.
"The light surrounded me from the depth of the night, and I suddenly understood what I did not before. I felt voices speaking to me, guiding me, and I listened. Then I knew all that had to be done, and I had the key to unlock it all."
Master Rin paused then and said, "The oligosphone was created by the prophet just after she discovered the atom. Most people think she is describing the mystery of the atom, but I think the experience written here and the oligosphone are connected."
"So the key could be the key crystal and not the atom?"
"It is a theory I haven't shared with anyone else," Master Rin said.
Rennick looked at the key crystal in his hand. What mystery did the key crystal hold? Rennick looked at the passage that Master Rin had just read and noticed a picture.
"This diagram next to the script, do you think it is part of this palimpsest's previous text? It resembles the crest of the Heros."
"Perhaps." Master Rin rubbed his finger over the faded, scribbled image. "It has the swirls and dots of similar designs in earlier texts which the crest of Heros incorporated. This paper was reused, and it looks like the previous images weren't fully erased. In those texts, this diagram represents Protic and Mu."
Rennick changed his stance and shifted the crystal into one hand. That the crest incorporated the old creation myth of their sons was intriguing to him, but maybe the diagram represented something else.
"What if the stars represent the night aura? Perhaps it was the start of the design for the oligosphone."
"But the prophet is mentioning a focused light. Without an oligosphone, how did she have such an experience?"
"If these designs aren't Protic and Mu, then maybe she had some sort of device, a precursor to the oligosphone that the light represents."
"But the key crystal on its own isn't enough."
The master looked at the crystal in Rannick's hand.
"You'd better take that back."
Rennick nodded. Excited at the idea of discovering something completely new, he almost forgot he was holding the key crystal. He turned, making his way back to the tower.
"Be careful, that one is the best I have ever seen," added Master Rin.
Rannick switched the crystal to his other hand and used his free hand to hold the railing on the stairs. He tried to concentrate, but his mind wandered. If the Prophet had a device, what would that be? The door to the room in the crystal tower was still open, and he maneuvered easily back to his spot. Rannick looked up, and because the shutter at the top of the tower was closed, the crystals hung down, dusted in shadow. The small globe light beside Rannick did nothing to reveal the true nature of the oligosphone. The metal matrix cradled the crystals with golden fingers, and in full use, the instrument was like a large, glorious piece of jewelry. Rannick cringed, seeing the empty finger where the key crystal belonged. Without that finger's adorning crystal, even if the shutters were open, the illuminating light would be unfocused and diffuse. The finger pointed to Rannick, waiting. Rannick held his breath as he carefully palmed the key crystal, reached above his head, and pushed it into place. It slid in easily. "That's better, isn't it?" he said out loud. Satisfied, he removed the gloves and instinctually pulled the lever on a wall next to him, releasing the shutter to expose the crystals to the morning light. Opening the shutter whenever he liked was one privilege of his position. There weren't many. The crystals came to life as the shadow was chased away. Daylight didn't pulse the same as the night aura, but Rannick enjoyed the reflections that sparkled around the room, and the key crystal focused a rainbow down to the window by his feet. As he looked at the rainbow, a flash pulsed through the key crystal, blinding Rannick for a moment. He felt his knees give way to dizziness and darkness. Prime Secretary Alton was on Shimtu's infopad, his face and shoulders taking up the whole of the screen as he spoke. "Shimtu, we want to recommend you to the Secretariat on Planning. You just have to keep providing us with the names of the travelers and your observations. The changes are coming soon, and you will be a part of it." Shimtu liked the words he was hearing from the Prime Secretary. He enjoyed his work, but this would establish him so he could have his own home and start a family.
"It would be an honor. Can you tell me what the changes are? Is it true the Great Discovery Treks will be shut down?"
And there Nina Kessler obviously hit the wall of the length limits with the Navigators. Finally, at elapsed time, 37 minutes and 20 seconds, VPL Podshop number 2 completes its fiction portion with manuscript number 4, The Samhain Murders by Keith Mabbs. Chapter 1, Erin. Sunday, November 2. Yesterday I was normal, as far as that went, considering how I was raised. I'm a detective on the Port Alberni Police Force, Alberni Island, Canada, one of two women in that gentleman's club. Laurel O'Connor is currently on vacation in Ireland. I hope she's having a good time, because here, not so much. Right now I'm standing at a murder scene, my car idling behind me, forgotten. Somehow I had heard the carrion birds calling me to this body. The caw of ravens and crows, the harsh squawk of seagulls. Their cry had gathered weight in my mind, building with pressure, and then, with a release, it slithered into the place where my magic used to be quiet and gentle. Now it roared, making a sound like rocks grating together somewhere deep in my hindbrain. I'd followed that call, the dread building up in me. Would I always hear a murder this way, in the future, in the back of my mind, grating away like stones? God, I hope not. It was bad enough when the few bodies I'd seen had stopped me in my tracks. Cold. None of the other detectives has noticed yet, not even Jack. They just think I'm taking in the scene, or keeping my last meal in place. One day that would get me in trouble if I didn't learn to deal with it. The highway teed at the beach. The burnt leaves of autumn's turning soaked the road, making it slippery with the morning dew. In front of me was the wet gold of the beach and the dark platinum of rock and stone rising from the sand like grave markers. Ahead, the ravens, gulls, and crows that had pulled me here were rising with the tide and then banking to land again. Their bodies flowed through the tree, full-grown and solid. It would be a large species, like an oak tree, if it had been physical. I stopped. A shiver planted me to the ground as if someone had walked over Graham's grave. I took a breath, and it faded, too slowly, but I could move again. The tree stood 10 feet tall. Tendrils of color swirled around it. Misty pinks, silver blues, grays. They shifted and changed in hue and saturation, sometimes translucent, other times as dense as thunderclouds. And underneath it, yeah, that's what had paralyzed me. The body. Now that I was closer, the carrion bird's shrieks were like banshees or something from a lost world, a high-keening wail I wanted to drive from my skull. I went back to my car to call the station and my partner, Jack Greer.
Dispatch, this is Detective Aaron Gray. Find Jack and tell him to come out to the North End Highway 4. It's at 10:59. Call the car owner, too.
There was a moment's silence from dispatch. I knew it was more than lag. We're a small town. We don't get many murders.
Roger, detective.
There was a quiver in her voice.
Then I popped the trunk and grabbed the handle of my forensics kit. I was accredited to gather evidence. All police officers are. They call it without prejudice. Personally, I am prejudiced. Murder is a crime that deserves my hatred. All of it. Every scrap I borrowed, owned, or claimed over the years, because that's how Graham's had died. I was more than willing to share that grief, to shove it down the throat of whomever took a life needlessly. The walk down to the beach should have been peaceful, but instead it was unnerving. I noticed two ravens, larger than most. As I drew closer, they spread their wings, almost 6 feet across. Eyes that pierced mine, thick, heavy beaks, dressed all in obsidian. Too large, way too large. I could see something odd about them as well, but I had no reference point for it. That difference from yesterday I was talking about let me see their inner coloring, a radiant black, as if with age, or maybe a magic so old. I gave up trying to piece it together. Scavenger birds are territorial. They have a pecking order. The gulls and crows shouldn't have been here, or they should have driven off the ravens the way they did other predator birds. But I could understand why they hadn't. I could feel the raven's presence from 20 feet away, like the beat of a heart.
"Hey, boyos!"
I screamed, driving the birds off. Most of the carrion birds left, and the squawking stopped. The shriek in my skull abated. The two ravens stayed, perched on a driftwood log. Silent, they watched, the shiny black of their eyes tracking me as I moved. It was creepy, being watched like that. All that presence. The unnerving part, other than my unworldly friends, came from having to process the body. How did anybody get used to this? I taped off the area. I tried not to look. Really. I made notes in a logbook, the time I arrived, the condition of the scene, who was here, and what anything I noticed. Then I circled the scene, snapping photos from all four corners, even if the beach didn't have them, divorcing myself through the lens. First of the ground, focusing on the footprints. Then the circle of stones. Three of them, each with eight rocks the size of a large man's fist. One circle inside of each other. Each stone had a symbol etched in the rock, as if scored there by a brand hot enough to sear rock. 24 runes in total. 24 candle stubs on each rock. The four main compass points were slightly out of round. The north stone of each circle seemed to push outward a bit, as if being marked. I looked up at the tree I wouldn't have been able to see yesterday. I took a picture just in case. Several. I put my hand against the trunk. There was force there, resistance, a form of inertia. The almost rough texture of bark. I pushed my hand through it. The feeling of ants crawling from under my skin. I shook my hand violently until the sensation quieted. Then I looked down. The trunk burst from her chest, and the roots, gnarled and heavy, the way they spread through her body, up and out over her breasts, down her stomach and into the ground, as if a seed had been cast and she was fertile ground for the sapling. This was a spell. I didn't think it could be anything else, not from what Graham's had taught me. A bloody powerful one. But what did it do? Using a life to feed it.
A shudder fueled the dread I had been feeling, growing into... I didn't even want to think of an emotion worse than that. My stomach clenched tighter still. The girl was young. Lying on the ground, she looked about 5'6". Her top was missing and her bra, but her pants were still on. I breathed a sigh of relief. Her hair, because it was wet, looked redder than the strawberry blonde really was, and her eyes were a dull gray, the white haze of cataracts already formed. There were footprints beside the body, two sets, one smaller with less depth than the other one had. It showed a weight difference, maybe a sex difference, too. Feathers ruffled my unearthly friends, stretching out their wings, posturing. They settled down, but not until my creep factor had ratcheted up a notch. The rest of the scene was macabre. There was a round hole in the girl's chest. A perfect circle, but the edges of the wound were ragged, as if someone had plunged a cookie cutter through the skin and bone, breaking the ribs open. The force needed for that? I shook my head, trying to get the image out. I wasn't even partially successful. Her heart was missing, lifted right out of her chest. A loaf of bread sat beside the body, broken open, a large piece missing, as if he or she, the killer, had broken bread with the dead. A trail of blood drops lay in a line over the girl's chest, pale white skin with crimson spots. Then they scattered on the ground, stopping between the footprints there. I felt goosebumps shift over my skin. The missing piece of bread had been dipped in the pool of blood on the girl's chest and then eaten. I was sure of it. And I thought Heckle and Jekyll made me feel creepy. A cloying mist coalesced around the bread, turning into a tendril like a vine. It worked its way to the roots of the tree, finding purchase there. The other odd thing was that the carrion birds hadn't touched the bread, only the body. Nor had any animal inherent to the beach or woods in the area. It was as if the bread was fouled somehow. Something about that nagged at me. I closed my eyes, sensing the world around me. Today, everything was filled with magic, more than yesterday. The breath of the ocean as it misted over me, the sand under my feet, the slight rumble of the waves, even the black of the ravens glowed with a vitality that wasn't normal. And Jack, as he walked up behind me, the soft rustle of his trench coat different from the waves giving me a warning of his presence, glowed with the warm embers of a fire residing in his chest. Without even looking at him, I could see that. A new visual that went with the warm feelings I had for him. Like me, he wore hiking boots and jeans. A silk dress shirt covered his torso. I wore a t-shirt and a cashmere sweater with a lambskin jacket over it all for the cold. Jack is aging, gray at the temples of his black hair. He's native, though the rounded features of that heritage have the stark angles of an Irish mother's bloodline to hang off. He's a decidedly good-looking man. Very fit. Jack? I turned to look at him, opening my eyes. He'd bowed his head. I heard him mumble, "God bless this child." Our religions shared the sanctity of life, at least. "You okay, Aaron?" As he said it, the ravens took flight. I found myself taking a breath, relieved. "No, shoot me if I'm ever okay at a murder scene." "That would be a challenge." He smiled and looked at me with an intensity I was just getting used to. Jack made eye contact with people. It was one of the ways he showed concern. It did other things, too, kept most people honest, unnervingly so. But Jack's presence was easing up my shoulders already. It's what he did. Made the work easier. As if all that magic in his chest, I was pretty sure that's what I was seeing, let him keep the people around him calm and easy. No slight trick, that. I pulled those blue nitrile gloves over my fingers. They didn't keep my hands any warmer, but the evidence would be isolated the way it should be. I was hoping the gloves would protect my soul in some way, too, the things I had to touch. I started taking samples, the final photos of the scene done, the yellow tape snapped in the wind. Jack pulled a pair on, too. We worked in silence. It didn't take that long. There might be trace around the wound in her chest, plaster casts for the prints, blood samples from the spill over her chest. The ME, if he found anything else at the autopsy, would let us know. And last, a wax imprint of a thumb from the base of one of the candles. I stared at it, the fingerprint. It wasn't like mine, nor would it be like Jack's. Ours, every human being's, was a pattern of swirls. This one was different. This one was made of concentric circles, like the designs on some seashells. One more flash encompassed the scene as if lightning held everything in place, but it was just the camera I had used again. Jack.
Yeah?
Tell me I'm seeing things. He moved over my way and knelt down. What the? I thought he was going to swear for a minute, something Jack never did. It wasn't in his nature. Creation, he said. The print wasn't anything found on a human. That was The Samhain Murders by Keith Mabb, the fourth person you've met today who cherishes an ambition to be paid for making stuff up. Before we do anything else, let us salute them one and all for their bravery, their commitment, and their optimism. And now, at 51 minutes into this pod shop, we arrive at the comments section. As in Podshop number 1, I will arrange the comments by story, concluding each story's comments with my own. I may or may not have general comments left over at the very end. I've decided to put the story comments in the same order in which writer's fiction will appear in this Podshop series, so we'll begin with Christy Cherish's comments on Tracy Ekdahl's Domestic Disturbance. Hi, Tracy. I really liked this piece and enjoyed reading it. I got a real kick out of finding out the wife was actually dead. I think you handled the revelation well, and I smiled as she went about her day talking at her husband. I'm not sure if it was intentional, but I thought you portrayed what many unhappy marriages probably look like, a complete lack of communication. I liked the touches that the cruise and the anniversary glasses gave to the piece. You painted a vivid picture of the wife and husband, and I liked your ending where the two of them get stuck with each other forever. In a short space, you illustrate two characters and develop a believable and poisonous relationship that makes for a fun read. I did wonder at the murder itself. You insinuated a gunshot. Since he has the body cremated instead of disposing of it himself, wouldn't someone ask about the bullet hole in her head? I also felt like the ending was a bit abrupt, with the husband blurting out that he killed her in the last line. I was looking forward to a final blow-up between the two of them. Thanks. Now here's Stephanie Cruz on Tracy Ekdahl's Domestic Disturbance. Hi, Tracy. I enjoyed your story. It was a short and easy read with a cool and humorous twist at the end. I like that your two characters are any regular couple in a failing marriage, or so you make it seem in the beginning, and by the end we are set up hoping they will salvage their relationship, only to find that even in death they still hate each other's guts. Very entertaining and reminded me of a French short story I read in high school where the husband poisons his wife after they try to save their marriage for the second time. Helen is a romantic nag. It's really funny reading her trying to guilt-trip her husband into romancing her when all she does is insult and reprimand him. I thought at some point that she really was going to poison him, but it seems that Tully already got to the killing part before she did. Aside from those points, I thought Helen's realization of her being dead was a little too sudden for me. How was this possible? Could she really be dead? She hadn't even come across the thought she may be dead, and all of a sudden she's wondering if she's really dead? I would have liked for her to remember that she was killed and have her act on that rage and kill Tully, because her character doesn't change in the end. She always talks about teaching her husband a lesson, but never follows through on her word, and I think intending to kill her husband will bring that change in her. Aside from that, I really enjoyed your story. Great job. Now here's Pat Doby on Tracy Ekdahl's Domestic Disturbance. Hi, Tracy. This story reminds me of the old Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Good opening. The more I read, the more enjoyable it got. No, I did not guess that she was dead until right near the end, so that worked well for me. On the other hand, it meant that toward the bottom of page 3, I was starting to expect something else to happen other than marital squabbling, after she remarks that she wants more respect. It's very clever how you worked in comments from the husband that appeared to be responses but were actually him talking to himself. Of course, even within that, there are misunderstandings, as in the reader thinks that she thinks he agreed to the cruise when he didn't, because he never heard her, because she's dead. When the urn came in, that's when I finally guessed it was her ashes and realized she was dead. So if that's what you were aiming for, well done. In other words, I think you did a really good job on this. It's a certain type of story that I have always liked, and you did it well. Thanks, Pat. Now here's Michael Donahue on Tracy Ekdahl's Domestic Disturbance. You really have a strong opening sentence. By the fourth paragraph, I suspected she's a ghost, and therefore, as I don't like ghost stories, I was determined not to like this story. However, the twist on the twist ending and the way you've shown how domestic life gone bad is like a prison made it a thoroughly enjoyable work of fiction. The picture you paint of domestic life gone bad is so real, vivid, and soulless. Well done. The hints you drop about their relationship, the suggestion of poising a cruise to help with their troubles, are cleverly delivered. I found your reveal and resolution nicely paced and efficiently worded. As a reader, I wanted to get to the ending quickly, so you might consider tightening up the middle. But upon rereading your writing, I'm struck by how economical it is, so I'm not sure if anything does need changing here. In summary, this is a great literary story on domestic life. For me, this story is as silky as Spider's voice. Gosh. Next, Daniel Gore's comments on Domestic Disturbance. I love your opening. I am instantly hooked on this character, both out of dark amusement and curiosity as to why she would want to kill someone. Of course, getting into it, we're immediately brought to understand her reasoning, and it's quite saddening, which of course draws me in further. I also like how you slowly play out her realization that she is dead. I realize that this is a short story, perhaps edited to be within the constraints of the project, but it still feels cut off. I'm left wondering such things as, why did he kill her, how did he get away with it, and why didn't she know? What were the circumstances? This has the potential to be drawn out into a longer story if you feel compelled. Good work. I have comment from Nina Kessler, but not on this story. Next, Keith Mabb's comments on Domestic Disturbance. This story had the sense of a venting session at the start, just another reason to kill someone for all the hateful reasons one could find, with no sense that it would actually happen. The ending gave this piece justice, the fact that the husband felt the same way and did get his just desserts at the end, and the wife being capable of giving it to him. While the writer gave out hints along the way, they were innocuous and could be tech-related in one case, the phone not working, rather than related to a murder or the husband just out and out ignoring the wife he was tired of hearing bitch about everything, the reason he cleaned up after himself. Great for showing the dynamic of a relationship, though. The surprise ending made this story, but I think the story needs a stronger sense of foreshadowing to bring out the suspense of murder rather than the act of venting over a spouse. The story was well written and flowed well. Next, Greg Stevens on Domestic Disturbance. I think this is an excellent piece of short fiction. Short, sweet, to the point, and with a twist at the end to set the blade. I wouldn't change a thing. I especially like the first-person narrative. I didn't know I was already dead. Wonderful. I also like the terseness. Sometimes a story doesn't need to be any longer than it already is. I'm easily able to identify with the protagonist, a dead woman, while I'm a living man. Quite nice indeed. Gregory Scott Stevens. Next, Steve Robson with a different take on Domestic Disturbance. The really good part about this story is that I mostly wanted to read on to see what happened next. That's a good thing. The bad thing is that this is literally a case of, that's all she wrote. If it wasn't for the word end at the end, I would have taken this to be the setup, the first half of a longer short story, as is indeed the case with my own story contribution. It appears to be a sort of Thorne Smith's topper, but without the fun, apparently. I think the main problem is that the gag is just not that good. Also, the punchline is spelled out, which ruins it as it does not let the reader's mind complete the joke and thus further robs it of any residual wit or punch. As an example of this is the story of an exchange between Winston Churchill and Lady Belvedere. Lady Belvedere:
Winston, you're drunk!
Churchill:
Madam, you're ugly, but tomorrow I shall be sober.
I can't think how many times I've heard people misquote that last line as,
tomorrow I shall be sober, but you will still be ugly.
All the wit is thus robbed from the exchange, as you can see. Having spelled out the punchline in Domestic Disturbance, the joke, weak enough as it is, falls even flatter. The piece reminds me of M.R. James's ghost stories, which are unsatisfying because they are more good sketch-outs of a potential story plotline than good ghost stories in and of themselves. This piece is a good start point for a story. The stage is set, and with not too much shrubbery. So, carry on. I've checked carefully and don't seem to find any comments from Jeffrey Stevens this time around. My apologies if that's due to a screw-up on my part. Finally, we come to Melissa Tepperman's comments on Tracy Ekdahl's domestic disturbance. This story was great. It had me right up to the end. You could really see these characters. They came alive. And in using these two personality types, you were able to really get the plot twist to work flawlessly. Great work with your features description and home settings. I got a great mental image. The parts I enjoyed, the crunching of toast. I can really see this driving someone crazy. The fishnets, you were so light on your feet, good memory and meaning. Anna was her name and birth date. This part gave me the chills. It had me gripped. The ending, brilliant. It was scary, creepy, and I was happily satisfied. Finally, my own comments on Tracy Ekdahl's domestic disturbance. I'm going to be brief, as it's sub-zero and windy out here on Bowen Island, and the power keeps going out for hours at a time. I've been saving my changes every 10 seconds. I basically agree with the sentiment of the mob. This is an absolutely textbook example of a classic kind of story that might have appeared at any time in the past 50 years in, Alfred Hitchcock, as Pat Dobie suggested, or Ellery Queen, or fantasy and science fiction, or Worlds of If, or Weird Tales, or Amazing, or Fantastic, or Zachary's Midnight Snacks. The list goes on. With a little padding, it might have made a 15-minute Night Gallery segment, or even a half-hour Twilight Zone episode. From grab-'em opening sentence to tomato surprise last line, it's a classic. When you get the tomato surprise, you don't just go, oh, you add, oh, of course, I should have seen that coming. That's a very hard effect to pull off, especially this economically. If there's a website out there that offers the public audio shorts or audio short shorts, by which I mean not pornography, necessarily, but rather short or short stories in audiobook form, domestic disturbance would be a perfect fit for it. And if there isn't, somebody should start one, because the market niche exists and because today's fractured attention span audience is just waiting for audio shorts and audio short shorts. Now, at 1 hour, 1 minute, and 50 seconds in, we move on to your reactions to Daniel Gore's The Raising. To start us off, here's Christy Cherish. Hi, Daniel. A lot of thought and planning has gone into this world. You have put together a whole cast of intertwined characters, and I'm intrigued. In some ways, this world looks like a medieval realm, with a tavern, slaves, swords, and magic beasts, but there are also some modern references, such as the secret police and the military rankings. I like the touch of the Sorin, and I got a pretty good idea what kind of creature it was from the visual. I want to know more about the world, the characters, how they relate to one another, and what their goals are. Because I was thrown in during Chapter 12, I felt very lost. Although I was able to pick up on some things, I kept wishing I had the first chapter so I could be introduced to the story, even if I only would have met a single character. I was confused by Chapter 13 as to the terrain and what exactly was going on. I really want to like this story and get to know the characters, because there are some very interesting elements. My suggestion is to let your readers see the beginning, even if it isn't as packed with characters, so they can get hooked and get a better feel for the story. Now, here's Stephanie Cruz on Daniel Gore's The Raising. Hi, Daniel. I thought your piece had good tension and mystery. I was intrigued by Kilam and his significance in the story, and what the outcome of Bren acting on his own hasty plan would bring, trusting a Sorin who could potentially behead him whenever it wishes. However, I was having a hard time trying to fill in the gaps of your story, seeing as you gave us Chapter 12 and 13, but that's only minor. I had a bit of a rough time reading your sentences, seeing as you rely very much on adverbs. Adverbs tell rather than show, and I felt that I was being told rather than shown by reading the story. Instead of using adverbs to tell us what they feel, use actions to show how they feel. By simply saying something, quote, angrily, unquote, doesn't show much how a character is feeling. I like that you give details on the events of your story and your setting, but where the details lack are in your character's emotions. When Jared walked in that door, I had no idea he was panicking about his Keelum state, and I don't know what a Sorin is and what it looks like. This is where details come in. Also, it seems to me that Bren and Andera have a love-hate relationship with Keelum, but I don't know any more except that he dropped out of class. I am interested to know more, though. May I recommend The Elements of Style by William Strunk Jr. and On Writing by Stephen King on the word said? There's nothing wrong with using said for other dialogue attributions. Said is an invisible word that doesn't distract from the dialogue compared to she exclaimed or he interjected. I believe using other attributions and tossing said aside causes reiteration.
Jared glared back. I'm fast when I need to be. I'm not going to give up on my friend. He, as you shouldn't, Bren cut him off.
Just by reading the dialogue, can't we already tell that Bren had interrupted Jared? Aside from those things, I think you've got a good story on your hands. Just develop your characters and their motivations more, and you'll be just fine. Thank you. Now here's Pat Dobie on Daniel Gore's The Raising. Hi, Daniel. This is a compelling story. The descriptions are clear and vivid, and the characters are interesting. It's not easy to critique something that starts partway through a long piece, so I will try to stick to the actual writing with these comments. I think you would do a good job of working in details without stopping the action. Example, the cuirass under the woman traveler's overcoat. The second line is a bit problematic because they can either sip or speak, but not both at once. I like the, quote, he's tied up. You mean he's lecturing the others? No, he's tied up in the shed, section of dialogue. Funny. I would like some physical detail on Jared in this scene. I feel that we are in Indera's point of view there, is that right? In that case, we wouldn't know why Jared is staring at the table, and we wouldn't see him staring at the door after she leaves the room. If it's omniscient point of view, it's not omniscient enough. It reads more like close third person or limited third person. If it is not necessary to have Indera and Adina's name so similar, I would change one of them. I loved the part about the couple going at it undrugged. I was not sure why the Major thought Bren and Indera were up to no good, but no doubt that's because this excerpt is from partway through the book. In the next section, I was not clear on whose house Bren and Indera were in. I thought there was good tension in that scene, even though I did not know why everyone wants Keelum. I also liked the description and tension in the scene beginning chapter 13. When Bren shouted, "Who's there?" in the dark clearing, then got knocked down, I thought, what a dork. All in all, it's a good section of story. Well written, funny in parts, and tense in parts. Thanks, Pat. Now here's Michael Donahue on Daniel Gore's The Raising. I like stories and chapters that open with dialogue. It gets you stuck right into the action. And you've filled the following two chapters with lots of it. You've got good humor in here, fast pacing, and it is clear you've built a strong world, complete with different rules and laws, critical for any successful fantasy novel. You've built tension and have subplots, so there's lots going on for the reader. As a reader, I find it hard to critique, though, as you've got so much going on. My confusion is likely to be the result of reading two middle chapters without knowing what's gone before. I'll be interested to hear what others think. One tiny thing. In the second paragraph, you've got Indera, Adina, and Aaron. I'm sure you've established these characters quite well previously, but you might want to consider renaming one of them or moving one of them out of this paragraph. On the whole, this reads like the middle of a nicely balanced action fantasy novel. I look forward to reading it in soft cover. Next, Tracy Ekdahl's comments on The Raising. I really liked this story. The pace was good. It made the story compelling. I want to know what will happen to Keelum. I found there to be too many characters whose names begin with A. I wasn't quite sure who Charon was, but I figured it was the Major's name. I was confused by this, quote, I don't know, but he wasn't the only one. I noticed at least two others in the inn that suddenly held a keen interest in our conversation the moment you mentioned Keelum. It would be odd for them to travel only as three, so there must be others. At least two, I imagine. Wouldn't that make it only travel as four? The Major, the Messenger, and at least two others? It doesn't say why Bren had ash on his hands. I would have liked the description of the Soren. All I know is that he is tall. This is a great story. You started at chapter 12, and I understood what was happening without reading the first 11, though I would like to do so. I would also like to read the rest of the chapters. I think you have something special here. Next, Keith Mabb's comments on The Raising. I had a difficult time following this excerpt because it started at chapter 12. So much of the plot has been explained before this point that the relations between characters are indistinct. Several characters are introduced all at once and with similar names. Without the background that explains how this culture thinks, the discussions are difficult to comprehend. The writing might be very good, but out of context, I can't see it. Next, Gregory Scott Stevens on The Raising. Nice imagery here, almost a medieval feel to it. Has a nice pace to it as well. two chapters is not a lot to comment on, but the one thing that strikes me in particular is the lack of a description of the Sorin introduced in Chapter 13, and perhaps the lack of a definition of the phrase quarter lance of predators. From what's included in these two chapters, I surmise that a Sorin is a werewolf type of creature, and that a quarter lance of predators is a group, 8 or 10, of hired assassins. If I'm not too far off track, then you've conveyed your meaning quite well in these two chapters. I'd definitely continue reading from here. Nice excerpt of a larger story. The only other comment I find on the raising is from Melissa Tepperman. This was a good challenge, to read a part of a story where you have to sort of fill in the blanks, to be able to get the feeling, setting, and characters right away, and I felt that I was able to do this well due to the way it was written. You did a decent job of keeping all your characters well controlled. I was able to keep up with each one. The setting was great, cold, remote, and mysterious. In Chapter 13, the part, quote, "broad, heavy leaves still covered its branches, defiant of the freezing winds and heavy snow," unquote. I loved that great mental image. I enjoyed that the women were assassins. Nice touch. The Sorin creature at the end was cool, that it was able to know and mimic Bren's language. I am very curious to know what will happen. Good job. And now we're down to my own comments on Daniel Gore's The Raising. Once again, I agree with a lot of the things the rest of you said, and I was especially struck by a point Pat Dobie raised about viewpoint. I can't really tell from either of these middle chapters whether Daniel's book ever uses multiple viewpoints or just some sort of omniscient narrator, but when you've got a story this complex and layered with so many characters, I, for one, am a lot more comfortable knowing at all times whose eyes I'm looking out of, who I'm rooting for, who's telling me all this, and how far I trust them. For example, the people I chose to root for, Bren and Andera, are upset with Kilam because he foolishly believes in conciliation and unity rather than being a warrior, which doesn't sound all that foolish to me. For what it's worth, Poul Anderson once mentioned to me a trick he used to keep the reader clear at all times on who the viewpoint character was. Poul would make a point of trying to invoke as many of that character's senses as possible in every page of copy, mentioning something he saw, heard, smelled, tasted, felt, whether he was hot or cold, excited or bored. It helps the reader plug in. Like everyone else, I'm a little vague about things like what a Sorin is or looks like, or what a keel infestation is, and so forth. But like most of you, I'm confident those things are explained earlier in the story, which means both that Daniel has thought a lot about this world and this story, and that we get that and trust in it, even in just a short excerpt. Finally, I too would like a lot fewer adverbs and alternatives to said. And now, at 1 hour, 12 minutes, and 10 seconds into this pod shop, we kick off comment on Nina Kessler's The Navigators with Christy Cherish. Hi, Nina. Wow, big world. A lot of planning has gone into this. You show an awful lot of your world and different characters all in a very short space. We start off with Rannoch heading for an inoculation at the hospital, which in itself was an interesting scene. We then are brought to the academy where Rannoch studies and lives and see him interact with the crystal and his supervisor, Rin. Finally, we switch characters and enter into a political discussion between Shimtu and Alton. All the while, you drop intriguing bits of information about the world, such as the recently equalized races, the transports taking people away for colonization, and an apparent religion based on the atom and the crystal. You have a lot going on. There were so many interesting details, I felt a bit overwhelmed. I wasn't entirely sure how all the bits fit together and never felt like I got into Rannoch's head. My suggestion would be to take it slow and decide when pieces of information need to be introduced and not give away everything at once. I also wanted to suggest starting the story in the conservatory with just Rannoch, Rin, and the crystal, instead of with the inoculation scene. I wasn't entirely sure how the inoculation fit into the rest of the story, and I thought starting with Rannoch and Rin would give you more of a chance to introduce the world in discrete pieces. I suspect that this world is quite elaborate and the characters are very well conceived. I'd like the chance to get to see the rest of it. Now, here's Stephanie Cruz on Nina Kessler's The Navigators. Hi, Nina. I thought you did a good job building your world and the different groups of people living there. I like how the setting is technologically advanced, yet it has a magical feel to it with the crystals. You really thought out your world and what it looks like and the creatures inhabiting it. Good job on that. I enjoyed the relationship between master and student, Master Rin isn't your typical strong but silent type of teacher, and their relationship is more like grandfather and grandson. I like that. It was a little slow getting to the action part of the story, though, and I don't see the significance of the scene with the nurse in the story yet. Rannoch has a certain prejudice toward the nurse and her people, and I wonder why that is. Then you introduced us to the Vita One treatment in the beginning and ignore it in the second half. But that's okay. This is only chapter one. I know it'll be important later on. I'm guessing you misspelled prickly pear plants. Aren't those edible? If there are fruits and other plants around, why would there be a food shortage? Every time oligosphone was mentioned, I kept asking myself, what is it? What does it look like? How did it get there? What's its purpose? You did mention it quite a lot in the story, but you never explained it, and I really wanted to know. If it's that important, give us details early on, otherwise the reader is left guessing. Was it an invention? Was it a discovery from space? Last thing, key crystals. Mention too much that it was redundant. Don't refrain from using just the key or the crystal or simply it. Overall, I think you did a really good job. Your concept is interesting, and I would like to read more. Now here's Pat Dobie on Nina Kessler's The Navigators. Hi, Nina. I like how you immediately establish the setting and the point of view character. Good use of dialogue between Rannoch and the nurse to convey what he is and what the Great Halls are. The scene between Rannoch and Master Rin feels odd and perhaps underrealized. Is Master Rin's wish to explore the idea in the old text meaningful to later action? If so, I would slow this scene down and maybe put a bit of conflict in, as in maybe Rannoch has something else he'd rather explore that they're already working on, or if not conflict, then mutual excitement. I was not clear on why he shouldn't put the crystal in his long vest. Was there something scratchy in the pocket that would have destroyed the crystal? In a few places you need commas or a period and a new sentence. Hard to convey those by audio, though. The scene where Rannoch and Master Rin are speculating, quote, what if the stars represent the night aura? Perhaps it was the start of the design for the oligosphone, unquote, is a bit hard to get into. I'm not sure what would help. Maybe have them engage in some shared activity while they talk so the dialogue has a few more beats between these sort of complicated terms and concepts. That avoids the problem of straight dialogue back and forth. In the paragraph beginning, Rannoch switched the crystal to his other hand, you might want to start with where he is, quote, the door to the crystal tower was still open, unquote, or something like that. I was not sure about switching to a new character, Shimtu's head, in the first chapter, but to see if this works, I would need to read more. Overall, I really like what you've got, and I hope you keep going with it. Thanks, Pat. Now here's Michael Donahue on Nina Kessler's The Navigators. I love worlds that are behind barriers. You've got me hooked as a reader just using that device. Your characters' dialogues and your descriptions are well done. I like how you've started this story really at the last possible moment, right before everything is about to change. The food shortages, the discovery, the Prime Secretary's evil plan just about to unfold. Nicely done. Okay, so your opening sentence is one that has tension, but then you erode it by writing about the pleasant walk and landscaping. How about either having a less taut opening to lull us into a false sense of security, or giving the reader a bit more tension in the follow-up? You've got a tiny logic bump with the nurse jamming the needle into Rannoch's arm, what you'd do for an intramuscular injection, and Vita-1 being squeezed into a vein, what you'd do for an intravenous injection. In either case, I'm not sure you'd feel it being squeezed into a vein, but that's just me being annoyingly niggly, I think. You've built an interesting world with lots going on, and as a reader, I want to know what happens next. This is the sort of book I love reading on a rainy Sunday afternoon. I'm looking forward to it. Next, Keith Mabbs comments on The Navigators. I enjoyed the concept of Navigators. It had a broad sweep and lots of room for development, a large world to play in, an interesting past to explore. Much of the settings and conversations are exposition, and while this can work, in this instance I think showing would work better. There was no conflict to drive the world, and none between the characters. Much of the scene revolves around an act of kindness that could potentially damage an artifact, but the danger of this act and the emotional impact on the two main characters and the world itself is lost to the reader. Next, Greg Stevens on The Navigators. There are a few good ideas here. I like the oligosphone, for instance. Some of the imagery is not too bad either. But I have to say, your writing is sometimes hard to follow. The flow of the story isn't as fluid as it should be, and some passages even seem to be disjointed. There are also several grammatical errors, and even words missing, as in, quote, "It was the regular transport to Growth Colony 42 on the nearest planetoid to Cassia, a planetoid he had never been," unquote. Are you saying that he had never been a planetoid? This might become a good story, but it needs some real work done to it. Keep writing, but keep working on your editing as well. Sometimes you have to walk away from something for a bit and come back to it anew to notice the little things that can ruin a story. Finally, Melissa Tepperman's comments on The Navigators. I enjoyed the dialogue. It was natural and well done. Rannoch's thought process was great. I could get a good feel for his character from this. The Oligosphone sounds very intriguing and beautiful, also an interesting concept. At the end, when Rannoch's knees give way, this leaves me very curious to what will happen. Parts I enjoyed. Prickly ear plants, adding welcome color along the way. Great visual. He could feel the liquid bulge as his vein tried to take it all in. Cringe, that makes my veins hurt. His slippers scuffling against the floor. I could really see and hear this. Finally, my own comments on Nina Kessler's The Navigators. It may be that I'm thicker than the rest of you. I was just plain lost through most of The Navigators. I never did get what the hell an oligosphone is, nor did I get a clear picture of the key crystal. Master Rin laments that he hasn't seen it in so long, and it is so magnificent, but then it didn't seem all that magnificent to Rannoch or to me when he got there, and Master Rin seemed unimpressed to see it again. Nor did I get why Rin couldn't have just gone and picked it up himself any time he liked it. It didn't seem to present young Rannoch with any real challenge. If it's crucial to the function of the oligosphone, and it's important to this society, why don't alarms start whooping the moment he takes it? I'm just clueless. For an opening chapter, I didn't get much conflict, as someone mentioned, or a clear goal. By the time I got up to Protic and Mew, I was frankly lost. On the plus side, I hung in there regardless, because by then I was invested in Rannoch and Master Rin, both intrinsically appealing characters. I am a 62-year-old man with graying hair and beard and cataracts. I had no trouble at all identifying with Master Rin, even if I sometimes had trouble understanding exactly what he was on about and what else he did besides tutor Rannoch. I would like to know more about the Serku, and for that matter, I'd like to know more about the Oligosphone and the Barrier and the Prophet. I'd also like to know a lot more about Rannoch. I'm unsure of his age. Has he discovered girls yet? Apparently not, since he doesn't think about them. I don't know what he likes or what he hates about his life. Does he do anything besides hang out with his tutor? Does he have family, friends, secret dreams, secret fears, traumatic memories, unanswered questions? I sure have some, which means I must care about the character. And one thing nobody else has mentioned interests me, the title. My late wife was half Portuguese, so anything about navigators catches my eye. I must admit I'm curious to know who will be navigating where in this so far static-seeming setting. I finally, at an hour, 22 minutes, and 48 seconds into the mix, we come to our last raft of comments. As usual, we'll begin with Christy Cherish's comments on Keith Mabb's The Samhain Murders. Hi, Keith. This was an interesting and easy read. The story flowed very well, and I liked the first-person narrative. I thought that Erin was very well conceived, and I believed her thought process. I really liked the magic crows, and I thought you described the murder scene quite effectively, hinting that it wasn't natural and likely involved magic. I wanted to see what happened next. I thought you did a great job weaving the magic into the story, and there were a lot of well-placed details that I felt added to the mood. I also did wonder how Erin knew the killer had dipped bread into blood and eaten it, since there didn't seem to be anything that pointed to that at the scene. Nice start. Now here's Stephanie Cruz on Keith Mabb's The Samhain Murders. Hi, Keith. I enjoyed your story. You set the tone very early, and you continued to build tension throughout the story until the end. The first line, "Yesterday I was normal," is very intriguing and hooks the reader's attention right away. I was asking myself, how is today different from yesterday? What made her fall out of normal? You used great imagery and phrases like, quote, wet gold of the beach and the dark platinum of rock and stone rising from the sand like grave markers, unquote, really painted a clear picture of the place of action. And the line, quote, the missing piece of bread that had been dipped in the pool of blood on the girl's chest and then eaten, I was sure of it, unquote, is very gut-churning. Very good job. A murder mystery with magic. I thought this would be a cinch for your protagonist, seeing she possesses magic, but I guess it isn't so, especially when the protagonist is a queasy investigator. I wonder about the magic part. Aaron and Jack both have magic. Do others in this story have magic as well? How does it work? How do they use it? Why can't they use their magic to solve the crime? And I still am left wondering at the end how she became not so normal. I had a bit of a problem with your tenses and run-ons. You've established that you are using the present tense, so stick with it, and as for some descriptions, use commas to add your descriptions rather than having them as separate sentences. It sometimes breaks the flow of your story when I read them. Overall, great job on your first chapter. Intriguing introduction as well as ending. I definitely want to read more to find out what happens with the creation, unquote. Thank you. Now Pat Dobie on Keith Mabb's The Samhain Murders. Hi, Keith. This is an intriguing start. Lots of creepy things are happening, and if there was more to read, I would read it. I like that it's set in B.C. and that this detective is inexplicably able to see things at the crime scene that she couldn't have seen yesterday. The writing is lovely. As a reader, my main suggestion would be to let me do a bit more of the work. Your character editorializes, if you will, by commenting on how creepy the scene is, the ravens, etc., more than once. It was creepy being watched like that, unquote. Not until my creep factor had ratcheted up a notch, unquote. The rest of the scene was macabre, unquote. And I thought Heckle and Jekyll made me feel creepy, unquote. If you take out these comments, then the reader can think, that's creepy, without feeling like they're being nudged from behind. My other suggestion is to use sentence fragments more sparingly. I like a complete sentence. You can make it as short as you need to without making it a fragment. Because this murder scene is both real and imagined, that is, everybody can see the body and the rocks and the bread, right? But only Aaron can see the tree. You might think about clarifying it. The murder scene was introduced piecemeal. I think it just needs some tweaking. Most detectives would look at the dead body right away and observe that she's topless, surrounded by rocks, and has no heart. You do address this by saying Aaron deliberately avoids looking at the body at first, but it is not clear why she's avoiding it. I really like the small town aspect. I like both the characters so far, Aaron and Jack, and the creepiness of it. It's cool that a tree, which is something we usually think of as good, is growing out of a dead body and somehow getting nourishment from it. Very dark and interesting. Thanks, Pat. Now, here's Michael Donahue on Keith Mabb's The Samhain Murders. Okay, I read your opening line and reached for my seatbelt because I knew you were taking us for a ride and things might get dangerous. And boy, did you sure deliver. Fantastic opening. Right off the bat, you've got me hooked. Really enjoy this chapter. It's well written, constructed, and has the makings of a good plot. You've got an excellent dramatic question, who done it, and build the tension, provide solid description, well-crafted dialogue, and your character development is exceptional. Your short declarative sentences are like gunshots. They work really well. You're writing from a female's perspective, and while I'm not well-placed to judge, given my snails and puppy dog's tails chromosomal makeup, it sounds authentic to me. Are you going to be swapping the point of view in the book? You've got a strong female lead who is going up against a truly evil entity. This is a fantastic story. Okay, enough with the gushing. Here's some things you might want to consider. You mention Laurel right up front. She's the first character you mentioned by name. Is she an important character? If not, then you might want to take her out. Your main character is called to the body by the birds, but you've got almost a rogue paragraph out of place. The one that starts with, quote, none of the other detectives, dot, 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 unquote. It confused me, as I thought Jack and the other detectives were already there. So what about either rewording it or moving it somewhere else? I wondered if your main character would think of DNA evidence on the, quote, broken bread, unquote. If the killer had bitten into it, then there should be saliva. But I admit I've seen too many episodes of CSI, so maybe that's not realistic. But it is kind of what people expect now. The story reminds me of Mike Carey's occult detective fiction, which I voraciously consume. As a reader, I willfully suspended disbelief, and nothing broke that for me. Your writing, setup, and background were all plausible and well done. Your character development is superb. Clearly, you're a talented writer. In summary, I found your writing and story so enjoyable that when it comes out, I'll be buying the hardcover edition. Next, Tracy Ekdahl's comments on the Samhain murders. Your voice is very compelling. The piece has a noir detective feel to it. I would really like to find out what happened yesterday. When forensic photos are taken of footprints and other items, a ruler is placed beside them to indicate size. You may or may not want to add that for authenticity. The rest of your forensics is spot on. I used to give tours at the police museum and gave lectures on forensics. Quote, 24 candle stubs on each rock, unquote. How big are the rocks? Did you actually mean there was a candle on each rock? Erin is well-rounded, and I have a good feel for her already. I will definitely buy this when it is published. Fantastic work. Next, Nina Kessler's comments on the Samhain murders. I was interested in the story, the idea that the police officer Erin could find the murder victim through visionary-slash-magical birds and a tree. She has a dry sensibility about the fact that she can do this, and it worked because it seems she has had this ability for a little while. And as she thought, she has to, quote, learn to deal with it, unquote. I'm curious as to where this will lead in the bigger scheme of things, and I like the descriptions used for our West Coast. Very nice. I liked some of your prose, such as, quote, in front of me was the wet gold of the beach and the dark platinum of rock and stone rising from the sand like grave markers, unquote. Very apt for the kind of scene we are in. What I found difficult was some scene placements that made it hard for me to follow. The paragraph that begins, quote, none of the other detectives had noticed yet, unquote, is actually a comment about the past that interrupted the current state of getting to the body. It confused me, and I wanted to get to the body. I suggest moving this inner thinking to where she is actually at the body. I also felt there was too much about the magical birds and trees before getting to the body, and in the paragraph that begins, quote, the trees stood 10 feet tall, unquote. I thought she had reached the body, in the trees especially, since she called it in. When I found out she still had to go to the beach, I was annoyed. I have a problem with the beach scene in that my first mental picture is of a body on the beach, and the interesting part is the magic. Because the detective is used to the magic, I would think she would have an immediate mental reaction to the weird layout of the body, that it was a young girl with only underwear on, the bread next to the body, and the fact that the birds had pecked at her body. She would see these before she started putting up tape and taking pictures. I want to live the scene through her consciousness. Then she could notice smaller details, perhaps, while taking pictures, the markings on the stones and the different footprints. I found her personal thoughts a bit too glib for the weird, morbid scene. For example, and I thought Heckle and Jekyll made me feel creepy, I think she can be a bit glib about the weirdness of the magic she is dealing with, but I think the horror of a mutilated, murdered young girl would make her serious, repulsed, horrified, or she could feel herself becoming numb, a protective emotional state where she is mechanical, if I am to like her. Otherwise, I can't relate to her, and I am not sure I can like her. I like the ideas. I would just suggest working on what is needed in each scene to help your readers see it better and to make sure to keep things in an order that is easy to follow. I would condense the weirdness of the magic she is dealing with in the opening scenes, because sometimes less is better, and as a reader, I wanted to get to the body. Thank you so much for sharing. Next, Gregory Scott Stevens on the Samhain murders. Very nice. Suspenseful and engaging, and another twist at the end to set the blade. Excellent first chapter into a larger story. I already want to read more. I was going to complain about some of your sentence structure, but after rereading, it seems fitting for the first-person narration. The only place I really felt out of touch was in, quote, then I looked down, the trunk burst from her chest, and the roots gnarled and heavy, the way they spread through her body, up and out over her breasts, down her stomach and into the ground, as if a seed had been cast and she was fertile ground for the sapling, unquote. It took me a few seconds to realize that it was the trunk, unquote, of the tree you were referring to. Other than that, I like this story. Really. Next up, Melissa Tepperman on the Samhain murders. This was awesome. I love the style in which you wrote the main character, Erin. Very original. The use of all the death-related birds gave a great gloomy ambiance to the story. I enjoyed how you slowly unveiled the murder scene. It held me to the end. The fingerprint aspect is fascinating and spooky. Parts I liked. Rising from the sand like grave markers. Awesome visual. Thick, heavy beaks, dressed all in obsidian. Perfect. Brand hot enough to sear rock. Crazy weird. It was as if the bread was fouled somehow. Creepy. I hope this becomes a book one day. I would love to be able to read more.
And finally, my own comments on Keith Mabb's The Samhain Murders.
I enjoyed this one a lot right from the opening sentence. I admire the audacity of a man tackling a female police officer as a viewpoint character. An old college friend of mine, now deceased, David Dwyer, acquired a fair amount of acclaim for poems he wrote as Ariana Olisvos, a woman in her 90s, and when he was finally outed, he was vilified by feminists for appropriating their voice, unquote. You go, bro. I also found that the story read aloud very well. There is a poetry to the prose, a musicality that I like, and images that resonate powerfully throughout. Like others, I had some problem with tenses. I'm not a big fan of present tense narration, and the opening of this story displays exactly why. It just gets too confusing too fast. She's standing at a murder scene, her car still idling, but other detectives, including her partner, are there observing her, but then a full page later she goes back to her car and calls in the murder for the first time, and only then does she get her forensics kit and walk down the beach to where the body is. By the end of the segment, Keith himself seems to have abandoned the present tense narration, and I suggest he go back and write it out altogether. The magic part is disorienting enough to the reader without the time shifting. But I like the idea of a cop who's comfortable with magic, Alison Dubois with a sidearm. And there's obviously some powerful backstory there having to do with Grams's murder, enough to make me wonder just how normal Erin really was until yesterday, quote, considering how she was raised, unquote, and how off the charts that makes her today. I also want to repeat how much I like that opening sentence. I place a lot of value on opening sentences that grab a reader's attention. One of my own more extreme examples would be the opening sentence of my novel Lady Slings the Booze. It was noon before they finished scraping Uncle Louie off the dining room table. I'm also unreasonably intrigued by the single interesting detail we really get about Jack. He's a cop who absolutely never swears. There's a fascinating scene in season one of the HBO series The Wire, a 6-minute set piece in which we watch two experienced homicide detectives solve a murder together by closely observing the crime scene, and we understand every step of their reasoning process, but neither of them ever says aloud anything but some variant of the word fuck. What the fuck?
Fuck me.
Fuck that shit. Fucking A. I can't wait to meet a cop who does not expleet. Those were the comments available at press time. I would urge us all to keep in mind the wise words of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, who said, "People with opinions just go around bothering one another." I don't know if it's possible to overstress that point. At the same time that I hope each writer finds these comments helpful, I hope you'll all take all of them with a grain of salt, especially my own, since having sold a mess of books may seem to lend my opinions a totally bogus aura of authority. There is no authority. Pardon me if you've already heard me tell this story, but I once bounced a manuscript at every one of 17 markets. Not one professional editor could find anything to love about it. And when I got it back with the 17th form rejection slip on it, I decided to reread it and see if I could figure out what was wrong with it. I did, and found that nothing was wrong with it. It seemed evident to me that 17 pros had blown the call. I started sending it out again, unchanged, and the first editor to have rejected it, Ben Bova, bought it on the second pass, and to make a short story long, it ended up winning me my first Hugo Award. It was called by any other name. As William Goldman once said about the movie business, nobody knows. Nobody knows what's good and what's bad, what will work and what won't. We all just think we do. I recommend you develop a smooth armor of indifference to the opinions of others.
unless you find them instructive or useful. If you've found these proceedings instructive or useful or at least entertaining, join us next time for the third and final pulse-pounding installment of the VPL Pod Shop. Between now and then, you might find time to prowl around my website at spiderrobinson.com or order a copy of Very Hard Choices. This is Spider Robinson, VPL Writer-in-Residence version 6.0, thanking you for the gift of your time and attention. Close the pod shop door, Hal. This pod shop is dedicated to my dear friend Jean Baird, without whom it would not exist, and to her partner George Bowering, who turns 75 in December. Happy birthday, George.
I'm sitting in my car, playing my guitar. If you want my situation, I'm a nighttime man, catching everything I can. If you want my reputation, I'm just marking time. I got the need to ramble on my mind. Oblivion seems to be my destination. Tell me, mama, don't you wanna go? Well, the road is mighty long, and I've only got this song. If I feel the need for company, oh dear Lord, I much prefer abroad. If you know a friendly one for me, singing suits me just fine, but singing just won't keep me off the line. Oblivion seems to be my destination. I said, mama, don't you wanna go? No, you really should. Guarantee it'll make you feel good. Some blues, and I try to pick some blues. Somehow that's not the way I feel. No, the night is much too young. There's still 7 dozen songs I haven't sung. Oblivion seems to be my destination. Well, mama, don't you wanna go? Say, mama, don't you wanna go? Well, mama, don't you wanna go?